Thanks for checking out this bonus interview with Bea Boccalandro for Chapter 6 of Performance Driven Giving. My name is Kent Sanders, and I'm a writer who collaborated with David Hancock and Bobby Kipper on the book. Just a quick note before we get to the interview. You may notice that these conversations have a bit of a different feel than what you're used to hearing on a podcast interview or in another setting. And the reason is because these have been edited for clarity and flow to let the material on giving really shine through. We appreciate you listening and hope you enjoy this conversation with Bea Boccalandro. Well, I'll dive in here. Okay. I'm just going to go through these questions.
Okay.
So in your book, you talk a lot about helping people find purpose in their work. So how does being clear in your purpose help people become more giving? What's the connection between clarity of purpose, but then also having a giving impulse?
I'm glad you asked that question. There's a lot of murkiness on what purpose means out there. And really, you know, in the English language, it can mean heading in any direction or something like that. But when it comes to like psychology, what psychologists talk about eudaimonic purpose, because it's really hard to pronounce that word.
Yeah,
I use social, and it's an ugly word. I mean, you know, I think Aristotle comes from eudaimonia, which, yeah, I'm not picking on Aristotle, but I use social purpose. And what social purpose and eudaimonic purpose mean is that you aim to contribute. And that having that social purpose is essentially being a giving person. And that's the type of purpose that I think is beneficial for people to have. There's a lot out there right now saying you should be clear on your purpose as if you had a singular purpose in life. And when you're clear on that, things will go much better. I don't buy into that. And there's a lot of information out there that purpose can be, you know, make it to vice president level by, you know, 2024. And that's a direction. That's a good thing to have. I'm not knocking that at all. I think, you know, I'm probably as ambitious as anybody else for that. But that type of non-social purpose, which psychologists called hedonic purpose, it's not about contributing, it's not about giving, and so it doesn't have any of those benefits of social purpose. So I think there's a lot of confusion out there, and on, you know, purpose is the word right now. Like if you look at Google, you know, like how many times people search for it, it's just taking off. But the helpful social purpose to focus on, I think, is social purpose, not just any purpose out there. And yeah,
that makes sense.
Yeah.
How do you think a lack of purpose affects people's motivation and attitude? If they don't have any clarity about where they're going in life, particularly if when it comes to their career and their work, how do you think that affects their attitude or their motivation?
Well, what we do know is that if you have social purpose, so if you are sitting down to work on a spreadsheet and your intent is for that to be helpful to a nonprofit cause or to lower the stress of a coworker or some contribution, some making the world a little bit brighter, just a shade for someone else, or if that's what you're doing, like if in your mind you're doing that, and in your heart, I should say, your motivation goes way up. Your ability to go into flow is easier. You work longer without knowing that you work longer, and in some studies, the quality of your work goes up. So we are hardwired essentially to to be firing on all cylinders if we're pursuing social purpose versus hedonic purpose. So they're really connected, very closely connected.
I think we lose that sometimes, at least I do, you know, totally. At times in my work, in the times where you feel like you're doing something that doesn't have a purpose, some kind of task or some project or something, you know, it really affects your motivation for it. So I think having that clarity can be so helpful.
Yeah. And, you know, we think like purpose has to be with a big P, and my purpose in life is to, you know, cure cancer or something. And actually that's not the way, again, like the way we humans are. So even a very small purpose. So those studies that I showed you that, you know, higher motivation, and by the way, we slack off less too when we're on social purpose. I'm thinking of a study that John listed from the University of Chicago, and the social purpose of those workers that they compared to the ones who didn't was pretty distant, remote, and small. So all it was that they knew that the work that they were doing, which was, you know, very, you know, just basic work, analyzing photographs for certain things. And that when that work was for a nonprofit, their employer charged less. So that's a pretty minor sense of, like, it's purpose with a small P, so to speak. It's not that they knew what their life purpose was. It's like they knew their task was, you know, helpful to a nonprofit out there. So if we're, you know, if we're struggling with whatever we're doing, you know, I don't know, putting items on a shelf or writing a memo or coming up with a PowerPoint, whatever our task is, and it just feels devoid of social purpose, we can actually just modify it, which is, you know, this whole job purposing concept, and do something very small. So even if all you do is you say, oh God, this task is just so dull. If you go, well, when I, if I finish it in less than an hour, then I'm going to allow myself to go in and give someone a LinkedIn recommendation. So now you've connected in your mind the completion of that boring task to doing something small for someone else. And guess what? That will trigger this higher motivation, this sense of flow. It will trigger all those things. So it doesn't have to be anything large. And I wrote the book on this, and I catch myself often just like no social purpose at all, just going like, oh my God, I can't look like an idiot on this presentation. I got to make sure it's perfect. Like, it's all about me. Like, yeah. I need to make sure that people realize how, you know, great I'm going to do and I sell this job. Like, I think it's probably natural to weave in and out of social purpose and hedonic purpose in a sense in your workday. But if you spend your entire career on hedonic purpose, it's not going to go very well.
Do you think we have a built-in need to help and give?
Yes. Yes. And that has been, so, we are so hardwired to care about others that we actually have all these physiological elements that make us feel for others. So one of them is mirror neurons. So literally, like, you know, if someone breaks their arm in front of us, that the part of their brain that is sending pain signals of the arm, that makes sense. They broke their arm. What is amazing is that we, as the witness of someone else breaking their arm, our brains do the same thing that their brains are doing. So we actually feel the pain. So this has been established. And that's just one little element of how hardwired we are to contribute. And when we contribute, we're happier because we get what psychologists call a helper's high. So we actually get dopamine in our system. We get oxytocin in our system. Our cortisol, so the stress response goes down. We're less likely to suffer from cardiovascular disease. We are less likely to suffer from depression when we pursue social purpose. So we contribute to others. So our society is set up exactly the opposite. Mm-hmm. Like our society is set up to make us believe that actually we're all at our best looking, do best in life, looking after our own interests. But actually that's completely contrary to what science has discovered. Now, it's been relatively recent, which is why the popular beliefs haven't caught up, I don't think. But there's no question that we have this natural inclination and we do best when we're contributing. There is one exception. And so extreme sociopaths, so between 1-3% of the population, this is not true for, because that's actually the definition of a sociopath. So that actually just proves the point that what's normal and what's usual is being hardwired to give. Yeah.
A lot of the things that we do in contemporary culture, including all the isolation we have now because of the pandemic, that's not something that's a normal thing, but social media can be very isolating. Ironically, it's social media, but yet we're on our phones isolated, interacting with others. Yeah. The way that we have so many more people doing solo entrepreneurial work, working from home, it's almost like so many things in our culture are the exact opposite of what we are hardwired to do in terms of being sort of these tribal creatures. We work best in groups of people and so forth. That's a really fascinating cultural thing. I'm not sure what that has to do with giving, but it just kind of dawned on me as you were sharing about that.
Yeah. No, I think that's a cool observation. Yeah.
What are some, you've had a lot of experience in the business community working with lots of different people. What are some tangible ways that business leaders can give to their team?
Yeah. So, luckily there's like many, many, many ways. And, the book has over 100 examples of, how to bring this to life at work. But it can be anything from, making sure that your team members receive mentoring to help them with their careers, to calling on, making sure that in meetings you call on the quiet participants, especially since the quiet participants are overwhelmingly women and minorities. So right there, you're making the workplace more equitable. It can be,
I love that.
It can be, there can be some really audacious things that you can do. As a business leader, like in the US especially, where we really have a living wage issue, that it's actually possible to work full time at a formal job and really still not be able to treat your children very well, or give them a life that will allow them to thrive. You can do something like, the minimum wage at our company is now $70,000 a year, and CEOs don't make more than 20 times or 50 times or 100 times what the lowest paid employee does. So
yeah,
there are just so many ways, and there are a lot of leaders stepping up to the plate. All of the examples I gave are real. So it's really great to see so many leaders find ways to contribute to their team members. And I think it depends on, what might be most helpful to your team members.
That's true. And I'm sure it also depends on, the industry and the particulars of where a company is and all kinds of different factors. But
yeah.
Now, the reversal of that is, oftentimes whenever we're working with a company or an organization, we think of, okay, what are the people above me giving to me? But are there some ways that team members can also be more giving to their colleagues, their coworkers, but also their supervisors and leaders, bosses, and so forth.
I love that. I love that you it's like give up. Yeah. Yeah, there are, again, like people out there are just like just blowing the socks off of like me, you know, so you have team members. So one of my favorite examples is an IT team that when it snows, you know, they're in the northern part of the US, when it snows, they call it winter recess or something. And so at like 2:30 PM, they all go to the parking lot and they clear the snow off everybody's car. It's not even just their own firm because they're in a building that has other, and, you know, it's like this totally feel good day because every other worker, which, you know, is like, you know, sometimes, you know, women in sandals or whatever come out and their car is pristine. It's ready for them to drive out, but they also enjoy doing it. So, you know, it can be something like that, but and it can be something really small. Researchers have found that like just asking people to do one to three acts for coworkers, and it can be as small as like, this poor person is really struggling to do the purchase order. I'm just going to sit down for 15 minutes and show them my tricks because I've been here 9 years and I know how to do it. That small little act actually triggers all those positives that we talked about,
that's
motivation
cool.
and health. So, yeah, so it, you know, it can be formal or it can be something small. And, you know, there's an infinite number of ways to do it.
Is it possible for, let's say you're a team member, you're an employee at an organization or company, and there's a culture that's not a giving culture. You know, it's a very toxic culture in whatever way someone might define that. Is there a way to start establishing within your sphere of influence a giving culture, even within a larger
totally.
Bubble of a very toxic culture?
Yeah, there totally is. So actually that same study that I just referenced, they found that the recipients of those small acts, so the person who got help with a purchase order, not knowing that they were being studied or anything. I mean, they thought they were being part of a different study. So really, this was not a cognitive decision on their part. They almost inadvertently and unknowingly went out and did three times more social purpose acts than they did before they were the recipient. So it's highly, highly contagious. So if a few people start being more giving in the workforce, then those recipients times three, I mean, you can see that very quickly it can lead to a lot of actions that are giving actions, and then you have a giving culture. So absolutely, it doesn't take that much, actually.
I love that. That's really cool. Okay, I have one final question here. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a connection between organizations that have a giving culture and how successful they are business-wise?
I do, but more importantly, researchers that have studied this do. So the one study found that organizations that have a giving culture perform 42% better than the market, for example.
Wow.
Another study found that these researchers did a 5-year study on which companies grow, and they had a short list of things to look at, like innovation and these things, and giving, like how giving or the social purpose of the company was not one of the things they were looking at. And they were shocked because it showed up as one of the biggest drivers of growth. So there absolutely is. And, you know, when you go back to what we were talking earlier about the effect on motivation and flow and how long you work, how could there not be, right? Because if you have all these people essentially performing, by one study, 24% more, so they produce 24% more product per unit of time, like how could that company not be more successful?
Exactly.
Like, yeah.
Wow. I love that. That's cool.
We hope you enjoyed this conversation with B. Bacalandro and hope you'll check out the other interviews in the bonus content for performance-driven giving.